All right. Hello, everybody. Emily, how are you doing this evening?
Doing good. We're exactly halfway through the semester right now. So,
oh, God.
It's going so fast for me, I feel like. I don't know.
Yeah, it is going very, very fast. We actually at Michigan have a fall break, which is very nice. So,
oh, really?
Yes. So coming up, we have a little 4-day weekend, which will be very refreshing for me to have a few days off. But yes, we are smack dab in the middle of the semester, listener. We hope that you are doing well and enjoying your semester or whatever else you are doing. And today is a very special episode. I know I say that every time, but this one is truly special. And we're so excited to be doing a collab episode with the Sounds of the World podcast. We have Dr. William Montgomery and Hillary Lester from the Sounds of the World podcast. And how are both of you?
Hi.
That's how I'm doing.
Yeah, I'm doing good.
Thank you both for coming on and for being willing to speak to us. We're so excited to just hear about what you do and your experiences in the field and your own podcast and stuff like that. This is so exciting. I get so excited whenever we get to connect with people that are outside of our direct field or from different universities, whatever, because I'm like, it's happening. People are listening.
I'm the exact same way. I'm like, I just feel like any musician I connect with, I'm like, oh, you're doing the thing. Like, how's it going?
Now I feel the exact same way when we start too. It's like, I know I say this every episode, but it's special this one too. So
they're all special. The listener knows they're all special. That's why they listen to every single one. We know it.
Exactly.
So why don't you both tell us, I guess we normally start with background stuff. So
ladies first.
Put me on the spot, Bill. No, I'm just kidding.
What I do best.
I'm Hillary. As you can probably tell by my voice. No, I'm a music composer. I studied at the University of Montana over in Missoula. I did my bachelor's in music composition. I got a BM in music composition. I then took about a year or two off after my bachelor's to just kind of enter the workforce and get a feel for the lay of the land. I don't know if anybody has graduated with an undergraduate degree, but you get that sense of burnout, and that's, you know, where I was for those first 2 years. So I really needed some time away from music. However, as most musicians can tell you, when you take a little time away from that, you really start to miss it. So I wanted to find a way to get back into music. I went and got my master's over in England at the University of Birmingham, and really just right before that, really wanted to connect with music and ended up taking a summer program, the European American Musical Alliance, or EMA for short. And that happens to be where I met Bill, funnily enough. So we met in Paris at a summer music program. But since leaving my master's with composition, I haven't done a whole heck of a lot with composition. When I left my degree, I was just kind of all over the place mentally. Growing up in rural America, rural Montana, you know, there's not a whole lot of opportunities for composers. And I really love Montana, but I just really was like, okay, I got to go back home. I really want to make this work somehow. And as we all know, as musicians, you can make your own opportunities. So that's kind of where I've been for the last 2 years. It's just trying to stay connected with music. Yes, I left my master's at the University of Birmingham. You know, I was living overseas, came back home. It was this massive culture shock coming back to the States. England is so welcoming with music. And I come back to Montana, and it's, you know, rural America. And just kind of, you know, tried to get the ground underneath me, get my bills paid. I had student loans coming due. Ended up taking a job in finance. I work as an operations for a wealth management company. But it's been this really beautiful opportunity to get my bills paid and to kind of fine tune those skills that I, you know, am kind of was lacking coming out of my master's. There was gaps in my harmony knowledge that I'm have the pleasure of working on. I'm taking some online classes for that. But really a lot of like the personal development skills that I didn't quite know I was lacking those coming out of school, but they're immensely helpful. And what I mean by that is like the confidence to network and the confidence to promote yourself just shamelessly and really enjoy the process of it. When I first left my bachelor's as a music composer, I was always had this mindset of like, I'm not good enough, I'm still a student. And somebody in my master's pointed out, you're a composer, damn it, you have a degree in it, like own that. And so I've really been working on just owning, you know, my presence as a composer and that whole persona and working on, you know, building all those skills, which has kind of led me down this rabbit hole of how can I teach these skills? If I'm, you know, if I struggled coming out of college with these, certainly there's other students that struggled with as well, which is, you know, kind of launched this, it was a side project for me now, and it's starting to become more and more momentous in my life. And I launched the Healthy Musician site back in 2020, just kind of as a way for me to talk about my struggles in music and talk about, I don't know, just the humanity of being a composer and kind of the behind the scenes, like, yeah, I'm terrified. I have imposter syndrome. This is what I'm doing to work on all of this. And it's led to a little micro following on Instagram, which has been fun. But the real joy has been I've had just a lot of people reach out to me over the years, you know, since I started doing this, saying like, hey, I've experienced that too. Or like, wow, no one's ever put that in words before. Thank you so much for talking about it. So yeah, as I'm, you know, hopefully going to keep pursuing my, not hopefully, as I'm going to keep pursuing my career as a composer, just pursuing this kind of personal development, life coaching off to the side to help empower other musicians to get those skills too and really own being a musician. I mean, it's so damn hard as it is. But yeah, that's kind of a little bit of my background. I'll pass it over to Bill.
All right. Well, thank you guys for having me on and Hillary on. This is awesome. I've really enjoyed listening to your guys' podcast, so this is great. But so I started piano pretty early, like at 8, and knew I wanted to go into music pretty much as soon as I, you know, was like maybe the second piano lesson. Like, it just seemed like a calling, you know? So in college, I went to Idaho State University, my local university here, and got my bachelor's in piano after, you know, changing my degree like 3 or 4 times and financial aid being like, look, pick something or you're out. So they were like, you got to do something or we're about done with you. So I finished my bachelor's in piano and actually had my first premiere of a piece at my recital that I wrote, and with a friend of mine. He played percussion, I played piano, and it was a really cool little piece, and kind of one of the few times they've had a student composition on a recital. So that was a lot of fun, and it really kind of spurred on the idea that I should go into that. So I did my master's at University of Nevada, Reno, and had a lot of fun there, met some incredible people. You know, proximity to California was great, got to meet lots of people there. I had a bunch of performances and recordings, and then I just like started applying everywhere for a doctoral program. And I did my doctorate at Louisiana State University. I started with the late Dinos Constantinides first, and then studied with Mara Gibson. And she was fantastic. She's an amazing composer, an amazing professor, and she's all about you discovering whatever you want. And she helps you, like me, my biggest music that I love, like if it's not classical music, I'm going to be listening to hip hop or rap. And it's like my passion. And so meanwhile, I have a friend who just finished his, and he's into electronic and electroacoustic music. And she's able to do both. Like, she was, you know, okay, let's do both. You know, Bill, you do this. Thomas, you do this. And, she's amazing like that. So my dissertation was on like what classical musicians can learn from hip hop artists as they put their words to music, and how that might change like writing for voice and writing, setting poems and textures and things. And my dissertation piece to go along with that actually used that a lot, with some Langston Hughes poetry and some other current living composer or poets. And I had to get special permission from LSU to get a performance because of the material it dealt with. It was, you know, 2 years after Alton Sterling, and this is kind of focused around on that. So, but it was great, and the performance went really well, and I had a couple other premieres on it. And after I finished my doctorate, I was kind of like applied to a whole bunch of jobs, and, you know, any job that I could might be able to wiggle my way into, I tried to get in. But I went back into teaching like public schools for a little bit, as like an assistant and things. And then I finally went to like making drumstick mallets with a company in Houston. And then like I worked in casinos, and I'm currently home working with Home Depot. It's not using my composition or anything, but I'm learning a lot of like patience and dealing with customers and
my customer service life.
you say that's a filter, but that's a real thing. It's a good thing we have masks on. I mean, so there's a lot of times my coworker and I are like, okay, yeah, we can do that. And then we walk away and we're like, stupid son of a. So that Home Depot, moved back home to Idaho and kind of started, met with some of my old professors, and we started, like, went to a concert and went to a recital, went to a, and it just like started getting those juices working again. You know, I kind of lost that a little bit. And now I could probably, since it's come out in November, I'm working on a project now with a poet I've worked on with before named Reuben Jackson. He's an amazing poet. He kind of got some fame for a poem about Trayvon Martin, but we're going to work together and write a song cycle. And so hopefully coming up soon, we'll be able to premiere that in 2022 and kind of getting things moving a little bit. Woo. Maybe get out of the rut.
That's amazing. Wow. For me, yeah. You shouldn't have. I'm honored to sing your song cycle.
Yes. I was definitely. Actually, I have two friends who are at University of Michigan right now. Adelus, who's a cellist, and Josh, who's a baritone singer. Both from Louisiana State University. They were both students of mine, actually. But we're gonna work on a piece for voice and cello too coming up. So
Oh, that's amazing. Oh my gosh. Okay. Yeah. I have so many questions. First, Emily, is there anything that you wanna ask or add before I
my next thing was gonna be more about like how you two met. And you know, the inspiration and process of creating the podcast as well.
Ooh, can I tell this story?
Yeah, I'm like, this is Bill's brainchild, so I'm going to defer to him.
Well, the brainchild isn't part of the meeting. That was just wonderful happenstance. but Hillary and I both went to the EMA thing. EMA, and it's also called the Nadia Boulanger Institute in Paris. And that's how I like to refer to it, because I'm
it sounds so epic, and it was epic.
But you stay in Paris for a month and you live at the Cité University in the south of Paris, and you study at the Schola Cantorum, and it's, you study with people like David Conti from San Francisco Conservatory, Philip Lasser from Juilliard, Benjamin Boyle from University of Pennsylvania, and
Neil Nomoff, who's a fabulous pianist. Yeah. Very good to hear him.
He was at Indiana for a while. And then the late Narcisse Bonnet, who was actually one of Nadia Boulanger's most loved students, helpers. while she was alive. So it was like an amazing experience.
Your music composer, it's awesome.
Oh, I know. And so on the first day, we were all sitting in this theater and we're introducing ourselves. And Hillary stands up and she's like, my name's Hillary Lester. And I just finished my bachelor's at Montana State University, right?
University of Montana. University of Montana. Go Grizz. Go
Grizz. University of Montana. And I was like, huh? I've been there so many times. Because Idaho State and University of Montana are in the same conference, Big Sky Conference. And so I stood up and I was like, I just finished, I'm at Louisiana State University, but I used to live in Idaho. And so Hillary and I both like locked eyes. And then we were like, this
to be friends.
Friend.
After like listening to, I mean, I felt like such an underdog there because like the five kids before me are like Dartmouth and Indiana Jacobs and like, I'm at Juilliard and that's how I know Dr. Lasser. And I'm just like, yep. I'm from the University of Montana.
And so we just like instantly bonded and we hung out all the time together and we kept in touch. And when it was all over, like she went off to do another like vacation off into Amsterdam and stuff. And I went off to Italy and then we stayed in touch. And then
that was during, for time reference, this was back in 2017. Yeah.
And then come 2020, you know, everything's in pandemic mode, or I should say panorama mode. And everything's locked down and there's no one working. And I was out for a couple of weeks and I was like, I really am bored. And I just, my wife was like, well, why don't you start a podcast or something, you know? And I was like, I could do that. So I was thinking, I don't want to do this by myself because it's always funner with someone else, right? So I emailed Hillary and I was like, hi, friend. You want to do a podcast with me? And she's like, oh, what? And I was like, a podcast, this is the idea. And so I spilled it all to her. And I was, at that time I was in car sales. So I was trying to like do a car sales kind of thing. And I was just like, so what do you think? She was like, let's do it. We're going to do it. And so I just like, was like, yes. And probably went into manic mode.
I'm thinking like, oh, we'll interview like one person a week for, or maybe one a month. And then Bill has like four lined up a week for like 8 weeks straight. By then I was like,
boundaries. Yeah, we did like three interviews at least a week for 2 months. And then
it was like,
I'm going to die.
Wait, how do you even
slow down? Because we're like, oh.
How do you even fine, because you guys have such great guests on the show. It's like you just email them.
Yeah.
Bill has taught me so much about networking. Like I'm terrified. I'm getting better, but I'm like terrified to email people that I don't know. And Bill's like, yeah, I emailed like 20 people and we've got 16 lined up. And I'm like, what? He's taught me so many things about networking and just being fearless. And just if you have an idea, you just run with it.
And see, the thing for me is like I'm terrified the entire time. So like I'll email someone and I'm just like, this won't happen, that's fine. And so I'll email another person, that won't happen, you know. Sometimes I shoot big, like I shot for Big Frida or Too Many Zoos, and then other times I shoot a little closer to home and like we interviewed a friend of mine, Austin or Kurt or you know, and we try to get the whole gamut, you know, of people who are like top professionals and other people who are just beginning. So we're like, And then a lot of people are just like, hey, it's free publicity and it's going to live on. And a lot of people have been amazing to donate their time and just be like, yeah, let's do this. Like we've interviewed Jared Tate twice. Yeah. And
he's an amazing composer. If you've never heard of him, go check him out.
Chickasaw citizen, and he's been San Francisco and New York, and now he's going abroad, and he's one of the judges for the Alta Music Festival. And I mean, he's an amazing composer. But yeah, so, and a lot of the things like people we've talked to, I've had some kind of connection with at first. So I'm trying to work something out right now with David Little, who did Dog Days, JFK, these operas. And, but I know him because he came to LSU and I was able to talk to him and get a lesson from him there. So you just kind of, you have that little minor connection and you just kind of, you know, talk to him. And it's always no pressure. So if like they say no, then it's like, okay, no worries. You know, we've had a few people tell us no because we're too small. So.
Got to start somewhere though.
Yeah.
That's true. Wow.
But you guys have had some good people on there too. I mean, you had Jennifer Higdon, right?
Oh no. We just did an episode about Jennifer Higdon.
Oh. Well, if you need a connection. I know her. Let's get her involved.
Jennifer, if you're listening, please come on the podcast. We would love it.
Fabulous. You want to be a guest.
So story time. One of my good friends, Elizabeth Knox, who we interviewed on episode 2, she interviewed Jennifer Higdon as part of her dissertation, which was a compendium of female composers. And so I was supposed to go with her to Atlanta and help set up audio equipment and bask in the glory that is Jennifer Higdon. And she scheduled it at a time that I couldn't go, which is understandable. You got to move around her schedule. And so I was like super bummed. And then my friend Liz was like, hey, you should check your email. And so I checked my email and there's an email from Jennifer Higdon. And she's like, hi, Bill, I'm really sorry you couldn't be here. I'm sure it would have been amazing. Liz is amazing. You're both awesome. Keep composing. You're going to do it. You're going to be great. And I was just like, I'm not crying. It's fine.
Hey, girl. Oh my God.
I'd love to hear just a bit from each of you about, I guess, your approach to composition. So like your influences or, you know, other composers or musics. I know, Bill, that you said you're really inspired by hip hop and R&B, but any other genres or favorite music to listen to that inspires that process. And then I even just how you go about starting. The composition is such a fascinating, ethereal, mystical art to me, right? That makes no sense. I think I've told the story on the podcast before that I took one composition class and it was one of the hardest classes I've ever taken in my life. It was so hard. When I tell you that I was this close to failing, like it was so difficult. And I really liked it. It wasn't because I had a difficult professor or anything. I had a great professor for it, but it's that the process of starting from scratch and opening, you know, Sibelius and just looking at like a blank score and it's staring at you and it's mocking you and laughing at you. The whole process is so fascinating to me because I'm so bad at it. So how do you even, right? How do you even like start?
You're not that like, bad if you're at University of Michigan, sweetie. So.
But I'm not at the University of Michigan for composition. So.
Oh.
I wouldn't have made it into the composition program. But you know, as far as your pedagogy or the way that people have influenced the way that you start that process, I'm so fascinated. So if you could each just tell me a bit about your process and give us the inside scoop.
Yeah. Bill, do you want to go first this time?
Okay. So my first bit of composing was implementing Stravinsky's idea that good composers borrow and great composers steal, right? So I literally would take parts from symphonies and concertos and whatever, and I would paste and glue them together. So I would create something completely different. And we had a composer here, Thomas George, and I brought it to him as a lesson. And he's like, so this is nice. I mean, I think Stravinsky did this really well. And looks like Shostakovich did this part really well. So where are you in this? I was like, well, I glued it. But that kind of really pushed me to kind of search for my own voice, my own idea. And the opposite, like you said, I love hip hop, I love rap, R&B. But the other biggest influence for me were composers like Mahler, Prokofiev, Stravinsky. Only recently did I get into Bach, because I just like, it just, it's like constant motion. It just drained me, you know? So I would, you know, kind of mimic those guys. And I love how Prokofiev uses dissonance and uses his techniques and creating so many layers and so many clean, audible layers, you know? They just don't overreach each other. So when I approach something, I'm usually like currently writing a lot for voice, and I'll read the text and I'll kind of read it in my head as if I'm reading it out loud. And I try to also kind of record how I'm reading it in my head. So, you know, when we naturally talk, we naturally raise and lower our inflections and stuff. And I try to kind of map that out on the page, like line as it goes. And then that kind of shows me where that is, where I'm naturally breaking and things. And then I try to, you know, I play that and then I just kind of let my mind go. I don't try to hold on. I just kind of let it not come out, but just like, I don't constrain things. And so I'll just start fiddling around with it, improvising a little bit. And the next thing I know, I'm like, yeah, that looks really good. I like that. Or, you know, using, I use Finale, I go in and, I write a lot for piano first. And so I'll like, okay, I like this chord. I want this chord. I like the way this tension in this, and it's kind of resolved, but it still carries on. I use a lot of dissonance, I think, more than some. And that's just like how I start, kind of. I just start placing notes and then I see thematic ideas coming through and then I start using those themes more and then I manipulate those themes and go back and see how I can manipulate what started with those themes and kind of, it's kind of the backward process. So
your turn, Hillary. I know, I'm like, I love listening to other composers because, like you were saying, Lydia, like, it's so different and weird and ethereal. Like, yeah, sorry, that was just really cool listening. I don't think I've heard your compositional process before, Bill, so that's super cool. I'm kind of on the other end of things in the weird ethereal space of music composition. I have synesthesia. I have several different forms of it. And if you don't know what that is, that means, it literally means like crossing of the senses. So for me, I don't have the sound color, which a lot of like amazing musicians like be like, oh, like the key of D is like blue. And like, they get these really cool color centers. And I was really fascinated by Scriabin, who's got the whole color symphony. And I get more textures. So when I hear sound, I see a texture, and when I see motion, then I also hear a sound. So the best way to describe that is like when you hit mute on the television. Like, I never really understood what that button was when I was a kid, because like I just would hear these like little things going on in the back of my brain. And I didn't really know I had synesthesia until I was in my early 20s and I was at university, and one of my friends was taking a psych class and she was like, hey, like some people see like colored letters. Isn't that wild? And I'm like, wait, what? Like, I see colored letters. Like, what are you talking about? That's normal. Like, went down this rabbit hole of like, oh shit, I'm totally like visual and weird. And So I have a few things like that. So music has always been this really cool visual experience for me. And I grew up singing, and my mom had she was the director of the youth choir at the church. And so I just kind of grew up looking at music and really enjoying these textures. And sometimes there's color to it, but it's never really quite consistent. I think my imagination has fun with it and throws color on the board. But so when I approach composition, it's usually from this visual standpoint. I tried Bill's method when I first got to school, and Comp 101, they'll have you try all these different things. And it was, when I got into my second year of composition, I kind of threw the book away and was like, what if I sketched what I wanted this piece to look like and then filled in the textures from there and had fun with the harmony? And so for me, composing is this really visual experience. I'll sketch lines, and then I'll just throw note names next to them of okay, it's this interval, but I want it to do this. And I just have a lot of fun. It almost becomes this visual textural painting in my brain, and then I'll go in and fill that out. But my influences with composition, I studied a boatload of art song in college. And I actually, I got to university, I didn't even know I wanted to go into music. Originally was in engineering, did not love engineering. Even though I did really well, decided, I was like, you know what, music composition sounds fun, let's just do that. And they're like, yeah, what's your instrument? And I was I sing. And ended up studying voice, falling in love with it. I studied it all 4 years, even though I only needed a year for composition. So spent a lot of time studying art song, and that's one of my favorite art forms. I just absolutely love art song. It's just the best for me. So I'm really excited to hear your stuff, Phil, when that comes out. But in my master's, I discovered spectralism, which is this idea of all these musical textures weaving their way into a piece. And you're working with the harmonic series and creating these really cool, your own kind of harmonic language within the harmonic series, or spectra, as they call it. So you're kind of plucking all these different things, and that just really fit in with the whole how I visualize music. And so for my master's, I ended up, I just did a master's of art, so I didn't have to do a recital, but I did this 10-minute spectralist piece, and I think it was one of the funnest things I've ever written on Sibelius, just trying to put all these different crazy textures together. And since then, I've been kind of trying to visualize how I can get that into art song and kind of mash these two together, because singers need help if you want it to be good. And so just trying to figure out these different ways I could play with the voice and have it be intuitive to sing and not sound just like a pile of garbage, but actually be something that, it's really important for me to that it be fun to sing, or engaging, because I don't know if you guys have all been in those choir pieces where you're like, yep, a pianist wrote this, this is terrible. It's not for voice, it's not fun. I'm holding a low A as an alto for miles and miles, and I'm not enjoying myself. So I'm always conscious of, not that that has to be fun to sing, but for me, it's more enjoyable when you're I don't know, you're in it, and you're in the musical moment, and you're just happy to be there. So those are my the genres I listen to. I'm a huge alt rock junkie, love classic rock. I'll listen to hip hop. I love the Rat Pack. We just went on a road trip, and it was Rat Pack, hip hop, alt rock, and classic rock kept spinning through. And then the romantic, anything from the romantic era in music is my jam. So
sounds great. Wow. Okay, listeners, you heard them. We're going to start the GoFundMe for us to commission a piece for Lydia to sing.
Yes.
From both Bill and Hillary, because they're writing all this art song. I'm trying to get in there. I want to sing some art song.
Oh my gosh. All right, I'm writing something for you. Not even
we can talk about it. Yes. But yeah, that sounds such an interesting and all-encompassing process. Have you experimented, Hillary, with graphic notation and graphic scores and stuff like that?
Yeah, which I find fascinating. There's so many wonderful, when I was at the University of Birmingham, they had these wonderful they weren't like lunchtime lectures. Actually, yeah, I think they were like once a week they had like a lunch lecture that we were supposed to attend. And this
tea one time gal, lectures.
Yeah, tea time. Gosh, I miss Brum. They had this one gal did this fabulous lecture on all about graphic notation, how she created her own. And with graphic notation, it's amazing in this way, but one of the big components of that is you have to teach the performer or the musician picking it up how to read it. And so she was really methodical about that and had this whole method that she developed, which I thought was amazing. And as I've approached my own music, it's been just kind of like, oh, but I know this, I know the, you know, the standard language so well that I haven't quite yet explored graphic notation, although one day in the future, I think that would be totally bomb if I can figure out, you know, how to really communicate how to read this and not have it be like a nightmare.
It's but hard.
It is. And like, there's so many different ways to do it. She had like photos that you would like follow the trail of the photo and like spin it in different directions and you would know what to do. But like, there's, I mean, I think I have like a Penderecki score behind me that's like kind of graphic notation. It still follows, you know, that linear concept. And there's so many different ways to do it. There's no rules. You just have to create your own. So I haven't got to explore that yet, but one day, yeah.
You and R did this.
Forthcoming. It's forthcoming, listeners. Stay tuned.
You and R did this. They were really heavy on improvisation because there's a big jazz program there. And so we had to take this class that was all about composing without using staff and notes. And so I decided I wanted to, like, we had to do an actual like program. And I did this one where I collected like 32 different photos and I put them in a frame, like a time frame kind of linear fashion. And then the performers were supposed to react to the photos. And the photos went from like off in the distance of space. And then like, it kind of slowly zooms in on Earth. And then it shows like creation of, you know, the evolution of animal and stuff. And then like, I'm sorry, but I'm kind of very political when I compose. And it's just that I'm a very political person in a socio like up. bringing kind of thing, you know, like bring everybody up. And so it showed like humans and then like the destruction that humans can cause and stuff. And the performers were like, whoa, they didn't know what to do.
Scotty or something. No, I'm just kidding.
And so then it went to like more like, but we can do this, we can change, we can make it better and stuff, you know? And it was such a cool experience. And like it was all done. It was 15 minutes. And afterwards the teacher was like, so what did you think? And I was like, I don't know. I'm blown away, man. That was just amazing.
I'll do it again.
Yeah, let's do it again. One more time from the top. Actually, I thought the 9th photo could have been different if you could. No, I was just like, it was so cool. Like, please, that was amazing. So.
Ooh. Oh. Wow, this sounds so cool. Again, I just wouldn't even know where to start with like a type of creative process like that. And I've always had a difficult time kind of thinking of myself as like a creative, like as a creative person, because I'm not like an originator of music, right? I'm an interpreter of music, which is still creative, but I don't know why I kind of separate the two as far as
it's so funny because like to me I'm one of the hardest things I did in, you know, in college was learning how to interpret, and they're like, you need to like be more creative, and I'm like I don't know, I'm a composer. It's like, no, what's on paper is on paper and blah blah blah, like there's no other way to. And I'm like, I think interpretation is such a creative art, and I don't know, I'm always in awe of performers when they get something in front of them and they're like, yep, I'm going to do that. Or, you know, or they trial and error and come up with all these different ways to do it. Like, I just think that's one of the coolest things. Like, I don't know. Well, I'm in awe. I'm like, how do you do that? I've gotten a lot better at it, but.
Well, and even as like a composer, like, I don't know, Emily, if you have ever done this, but like I've had violinists come up to me and they're like, so is that a natural harmonic or an artificial harmonic? Or, you know, I wrote like look like an ECG line or EKG line, you know, and I was just like, because I wanted it to go crazy and nuts and, you know, dissonant and just go, hey, you know, hog on the instrument. And they're like, so what do you mean by this? And they would come up to me and most of the time I'm kind of like, I feel the imposter syndrome again, and I don't know what I'm doing. Just go away now. You know, when, especially when they're like artificial or natural, and I'm like, whatever sounds the best.
I don't know what that, I mean, I know that's something, but I can't make that decision for you. Like, you're going to make a better decision than me.
Harmonics on the fifth, like, what does that sound like? I mean, I don't play strings, so, like, I put it where I want you to put your finger, just, you know? I don't know. Emily needs to teach us about that kind of stuff, because I...
I'll take a master class. I will sign up for that immediately.
Yeah, all the inside things about violin, I'll tell all the secrets.
There you go.
Emily, I don't know if you have any other further questions, because I don't want to take, I do still have like lingering questions. I don't want to take up your
whole time. Oh, yeah. No, we can go off yours. It's okay.
I do this too. Like, I don't like episodes where Hillary was like, I don't know what to say. And I'm like, oh, don't worry. I got you, girl.
And other times he's like, so, and I'm like, I have 15 questions. Let's do
this. Do y'all have favorite instruments or ensembles that you like to compose for? I mean, you both mentioned art songs. You have an affinity for The Voice.
Yeah, I love The Voice. I think it was studying it, and a lot of composers are pianists. So I feel like a black sheep composer who's trying her best to learn piano. Like, I'm trying to, like, right now I'm taking a harmony class. We're filling in those skills, but I just love the simplicity of The Voice, and I love those single lines. And when you can bring, I mean, even like choral textures, I think are just so much fun to write. Cause there's just something so incredibly unique about The Voice. And I think also from a bias, it's like the one instrument I really have a grasp on and can understand. I love like strings, and I love the woodwinds, and I've played woodwinds in high school, or I played flute, so I have a little firmer grasp of that. But strings have always mystified me because I've never played them, and it's, I just like look at that and it's so intimidating to me. So it's one, you know, ensemble that I'm hoping to get better with and kind of grow as a composer, but definitely addicted to writing for The Voice.
I'm the opposite. So Voice terrified me. It was the most terrifying thing I could ever hear, like, think of composing for, just because it's like, yes, there's thousands of different instruments and they are all slightly different, you know, but each person is different, mm-hmm. and each vocal range is different. And so that scared me, and thinking, well, if I write this piece, maybe only like six people could sing it, and then I'm hosed, you know, there's just six people, you know. So like, I don't want to go extremes into the registers, you know. I don't want to, you know, maybe they don't have the lung capacity to hold this long note, or something like that, you know. So like, I was an instrumentalist first, and I learned piano first, and then did saxophones, and then brass, and then percussion. I even learned how to play the bagpipes. I learned like all sorts of different instruments, and piano is always the easiest for me, just because it's who I studied for 20 plus years, you know. And it wasn't until I took David Conti's voice class at EMA, mm-hmm. that I was just like, okay, so this isn't too scary. Okay, voice I can do this. And then after that, I've done maybe two or three art songs. I did some other, or cycles. I've done some other pieces that included just talking over sets of music. That was like, so as a piano player, and then two speakers, and then there was actually dancers on stage. So it was a big collaborative effort.
Heck yeah.
And then my dissertation had two different singers and a chamber ensemble. And so I've gotten a lot more comfortable with writing for voice. And, you know, I've now fallen in love with the voice and love listening to art songs and listening to modern arias and especially operas. Oh my God. Like, yeah. I used to hate opera. I hated opera.
Way, even though like I'm like, there's the, you know, the split of the opera and art song. I'm like, art song all day, opera but you know, I've fallen in love with opera as well.
And that, like, I didn't fall in love with opera until I heard the first few notes of Dog Days, you know, and it's like, get me my rifle, and I was just like, oh, what is this, you know? And I was just like, I went to the rehearsal, I then downloaded the audio, and I just binged it for weeks, and then that led me into other operas, and you know, Einstein on the Beach and all these other ones, and I was just like, oh, these are so cool, where are these, why don't I learn about these, why do I have to listen to Monteverdi, you know? And so.
No, like, I think my first opera was Così fan tutte, and I was like, what is this, it's 3 hours long, like, I mean, it's a fun one. I do like Così fan tutte, but I just, like, as a 19-year-old, I was, like, not impressed.
Mozart, too many notes. Too many notes. Stop. The Emperor.
Sure, no, I totally feel you, because as, you know, I also did my undergrad and my master's in vocal performance, and I, you know, always, like, I was like, yeah, this is totally cool. Love the first opera that I saw, I remember, it was like a Spanish opera. I'm forgetting the composer now, but it's a newer opera that came out in like 2010. So it was like a mariachi opera that I saw in Phoenix. It was beautiful. So I remember seeing that, being so mystified, and then it taking me a long time to like find another opera that I saw that I thought was as interesting until we hit Benjamin Britten. And I remember seeing those up. Yes. And then I was in one of my first roles that I was in, I was in Peter Grimes. And yes. Like, yes, this is it. This is it. So yeah, I love English opera. I love 20th century opera. American opera. I had the same feeling around seeing Porgy and Bess for the first time. So, you know, lots of good stuff. 20th century and after, I think.
Yeah, well, I think like when you can dive into that, it's a really amazing, but I think like what we're shown is like Bugs Bunny, Barbara Savelle, like, I don't know, a lot of us cut our teeth hearing like these really older styles and be like, bah, I don't know. Like, if there's cartoons, yeah, I'll be there, but there's some really cool stuff out there.
Writing for violin, that used to terrify me.
Yeah. Oh gosh, really?
Yeah, there's all those strings, like there's four strings, and I was just like, can you do chords? I have big hands, like I can reach an octave and a half on the piano, and so like doing any of those strings combos and things, like I can't do guitar either, you know? So all of that stuff was just like and I would sit down with friends and be like, hey, can you play this, is this playable, you know? And
You have the double stops.
I'd still like, I haven't done much string writings. I'm like, I need to befriend some string players so that I can do that with. Or I'm like, am I an idiot? Is it a soft bass?
I did some double stops and they're like, that's the same note. And I was like, what? Like, that's the same string. I can't do a G and a C, Bill. I was like, oh, fart. So, you know, it's.
I could see that violin strings in general could be very tricky because it is a matter of if it's playable for certain things. I mean, we can, if it's a little weird, sure, we can make it work. It might sound kind of weird, but then there's also things where literally it's not playable as it would be another instrument. So that could be intimidating. Well,
I'm hijacking this. I'm sorry. I had a solo violin piece played called it was Elegy. And the violinist who premiered it, she was like, so this note right here is my wolf tone. And I was like, a what? Your violin will go, how? I mean, I don't know what a wolf tone is, you know? And she's like, no, it's like the way it resonates with the body of the instrument. And I was just like, what? I was so confused. I'd never heard that term before. And so I was just like, okay, play it. And then I could hear it. And I was like, oh, okay. So
Yeah. Oh, and that's tricky. Sometimes wolf tones go away. Like I got a new violin about two years ago. A year and a half ago. Okay. And it took like a solid year. It had a really bad wolf tone on my G string when I would go like really high up. And it was right in one of the main notes in the piece I was learning at the time too. So it was really instrument I just got. But it like, it went away, and for some it doesn't, and then some it does. So
that's fascinating. I didn't know this was a thing.
But you know, getting more into like the makings of violin, but it could be, my violin that I got was made in 2019. So it was made like within the year that I bought it. So it's kind of like shaped to my playing. So that could be why the wolf tone went away. But yeah, okay. Other instruments, yeah, then it could just kind of be permanently there. Yeah, that's crazy.
Okay, so that is gonna do it for this episode of the Theory Club. Thank you so much to Bill and Hillary for being on the podcast.
Woohoo!
Thanks so much for having us. This was such an honor to meet you guys. I'm so excited to check out more. I was like binging your podcast today at work and just enjoying the crap out of myself. So I'm like, I can't wait to listen to more.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you both for listening. I mean, thank you for reaching out to us. Bill actually emailed us and was like, you should have Hillary on the podcast. And I was like, no, we should have both of you on the podcast. I demand to speak to both of you. So thank you so much for being willing to talk to us and give us an inside scoop on your compositional process. I just find it so interesting. So everybody make sure that you listen to their music. I would assume it's on your websites. Do you both have websites? Yep. I've seen Bill's website. I have. Okay, yes. So I'll put, listeners, check the bio. I'll put their websites in our bio so that you can check out their music and their projects and whatever else they're doing. Make sure also that you listen to the Sounds of the World podcast. It's a really, really great show. They have amazing guests and talk to composers about their music. So it's truly awesome. So make sure that you give their podcast a listen. If there's something that you want us to talk about, read, listen to on this podcast, you can email us at thetheoryclubpodcast@gmail.com. Send it in. We'll see it and it might appear on the show. So yeah, other than that, thank you so much for listening. We hope you have a great Friday and a great weekend, and we will see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. 'Kay, so I just have a quick question for you guys. Does like weird innuendos always come up for some reason? Like musicians are notoriously dirty with their innuendos, or at least they were at the University of Montana and the University of Birmingham. And I'm like, is this a universal thing for musicians?
Every university I've been to.
You know, I did a theory paper last semester where I was really digging into music of Aaron Copland and Leonard Bernstein, and like the fact that they had a relation. I dug into American composers during the 20th century, I'm like, did they all sleep with each other? There was something going
on. Is this a thing?
Am I missing an invitation here? I mean,
literally, I was like, there's something going on here. We're like, all the 20th century composers like knew each other and sent some letters, and we're like,
yeah.
And I'm like, so they all, the conductors, like everybody was in on it. I was like, what's going on? So I don't know. There's some composer thing composers happening. I don't know what's happening at those conferences. I don't know.
Yeah. But I had never heard of that thing. And I was, is this common? Like, is this something I need to be worried about? Is this like a violin STI? I don't know what's going on here. It was like, what's going on, you know?
Those are all the blue, all the dirty jokes are the bloopers at the end. We always have our bloopers after this. I'm gonna throw them all at the end.